Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 90, Morphogenesis, Episode 1. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated sync. Sync gives you versatile access to music, podcasts, and more from just about any device. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark.
Potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today, we're going to get started as quickly as we can here. We're a little short on time, but this should be a very, very interesting show. Our guest is Dr. Celeste Nelson. She's an assistant professor in chemical and biological engineering. She's an associated faculty member also in molecular biology, member of Cancer Institute of New Jersey, visiting research assistant professor, biomedical engineering at Boston University. She did her undergraduate at MIT. PhD at Johns Hopkins University, and her postdocs were at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory. In 2010, she was awarded the Alfred P. Sloan Fellowship in Molecular Biology, and she made it on MIT's Technology Review's annual list of 35 innovators under 35. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Also today, we have a subject matter expert. We have our resident systems biologist, Andre Nontel, and he is a senior research officer at the National Laboratory or the National Research Council of Canada in Montreal. Welcome, Andre.
As always, it's a pleasure to be here.
So we're going to talk about morphogenesis or, and this is a subject I'm not very familiar with, but it's probably because it seems to be one of the most complex biological phenomenon controlling with elements of genetics, biochemistry, structure, chance. And so we're going to try and break it down to my level. But let's start. Let's start with finding out a little bit more about Dr. Nelson's experience and how she got her career going. So, Dr. Nelson, if you could tell us a little bit about how your undergraduate training sort of prepared you for your graduate studies and then sort of initiated the scientific spark that has launched your career.
Sure, yeah. So in undergrad, I was majoring in chemical engineering. I chose that as a major because I was interested in, I liked chemistry, I liked math, and I took a lot of biology classes on the side and ended up with enough credits to get a second major, which was great. But what really got everything started was an experience I had in the lab of Doug Loffenberger, who's now the chair of biological engineering at MIT. I was actually hired on to wash dishes in his lab at the start of my sophomore year. And a couple of the graduate students in the lab were looking for some research help and pulled me in on some projects, and things sort of happened from there. I was hooked on doing lab work and decided to go into graduate school in bioengineering because of that.
It's interesting because we have a huge lag today. I think we've got a 2-second lag, so I'll apologize right now. One thing, before the show started, I'd mentioned it to the chat room. Anybody who's interested in Sci, science, because we're talking sci-fi, at least in the sci side, go find yourself a lab and just drop your jacket and you know, work will become available. And so she started washing dishes and then moved on as a research assistant to a graduate student. And that now you're a professor at Princeton. It's it's the way to start. So people, get out there, get into the labs. And, you know, there's a lab here in Cleveland. Anybody wants to come and visit, we'll give them a tour. Okay, I'll let you get back to
Maybe I should add some context. Doug Loughenberger is a superstar in the systems biology field. He is a person, he is one of the person that whenever one of his paper comes out, I grab and read it immediately as somebody who is applying engineering principle to studying systems, signal transduction in cells, really doing absolutely fantastic work. I had no idea you worked with him before. I'm very impressed.
Well, I worked in his lab for about 3 years, actually. But again, the early part was just doing dishes, and I'm grateful for that opportunity to have started in such a fantastic lab. It was a great environment. Really see the cutting edge of this type of work, and also grateful for the graduate students for pulling me in on something. I hadn't really ever envisioned science as a career until that point. So,
and what kind of things were you doing in the lab? So how long, I guess you were there for 3 years. Is that before you started your PhD? And did you do a PhD in that lab? I know you went to Johns Hopkins, sorry.
Right. Yeah. So I was there for 3 years and then graduated and went on to Johns Hopkins for my PhD. In Doug's lab and Professor Loughenberger's lab, I did a number of different things, but much of it actually dealt with radioactive iodine, which is something I would never let an undergrad in my lab work with, simply because of the safety issues. But I decided to go on to get a PhD in biomedical engineering and chose to go to Johns Hopkins for a number of reasons, one of which was the training program involved both extensive training in engineering as well as the opportunity to take courses in the medical school. So at the time, the biomedical engineering PhD required you to take the first year medical school curriculum with the med students. And I thought it was a great opportunity to learn really about how the human body worked and to have that background in mind when applying engineering strategies to answering and addressing questions related to human health.
So do you consider yourself more of a biologist or more of an engineer, or are those two things distinct?
I get asked that question a lot, actually. I feel like I've been both for basically my entire career, and scarily enough, although I'm a junior faculty, I've been doing this now for 16 years, if you count all the way back to my experiences as an undergraduate student. So for all of that time, I've been doing both engineering and biology, and it's really hard for me to separate them from each other. I guess I consider myself both.
Well, so the question you should ask.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So the question you should ask anybody, any biologist who does mathematics, is MATLAB or R?
MATLAB. MATLAB. yeah. I don't even. Oh God. So. Yeah, well, you know, biologists are reductionists, and you know, sort of, it's about analyzing the structures and trying to determine new biological functions. But engineers are always thinking to the next stage, and I guess we're at an era of biotech where we can start thinking of applying some of the fundamental systems that we're now understanding towards as substrates for engineering. Is that how you're taking your research program now? Or do you 50-50, or do you spend more of your time really trying to understand this very, very, very complex system?
We're focused a lot on the basics, on trying to understand the system. But in order to do so, we have to invent new techniques. It's hard to estimate how much time we spend on one activity or the other because they're so integrated, and we don't have any projects that separate the engineering from the biology. But we're taking the approach of being focused on the biological question and developing whatever strategies are required in order to push the answers as far forward as we possibly can.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what are the fundamental questions that you're trying to address. So what are the main lines of your research program?
So we're interested in pattern formation, which a number of mathematicians and engineers and biologists have focused on for several hundred years. But we're interested in pattern formation in the context of how tree-like organs form themselves. So the organs of interest in my lab are the mammary gland and the lung. And we're trying to understand physically and mathematically how one gets such beautiful tree-like structures from an initial unbranched substrate, so an unbranched population of cells. We're interested in it because it's a beautiful problem. So the organs in your body, the branched organs in your body, are just fantastically beautiful to look at, but also has enormous implications for human disease. In the lung in particular, defects in branching can lead to a number of fetal anomalies, and we would like to understand the problem in such a way that we could describe it mathematically, not just as an analogy, but really based on first principles of what's controlling the process, such that we could. Sorry, go ahead.
So if you're talking about branching, so like I know Seawork, you work both on mammary glands and the lungs, and how much of it is decided by genetic factors in the sense that, well, if you have two lungs, two breasts, a mouse will have eight mammary glands, if I'm not mistaken. So how much of it is decided by genetic factors in which that everything will look the same within the same organisms, and how much of it is purely stochastic in the sense that it's determined almost like a genetically encoded mathematical equation, but there's going to be differences. For example, in a mouse, you have eight breasts in the same organism, so you can really see how similar they are or different. But of course, from one mouse to another, you can have differences just like you do in humans.
Yeah, so that's why we chose those two organs. Is they're a great foil for each other. So the lung, at least the major airways of the lungs in any one species, are identical. So at the gross structural level, all of our lungs look the same.
If Liz could please put on my screen for the graphic, we can show the structures that Dr. Nelson's talking about. Sorry, go ahead.
The mammary gland, on the other hand, looks different from animal to animal within even a single species. And if you compare bilaterally, so mammary glands on the left versus the right, it's not clear that they share much of a similar pattern either. So it appears to develop in a more stochastic fashion, like you mentioned. A lot of the genes that have been identified to regulate branching morphogenesis are turned on. So branching morphogenesis is the process that builds these trees. A lot of the same genes are turned on in various branched organs, but you end up with structures that look completely different. So mammary glands look nothing like lungs, look nothing like kidneys. And so it's an excellent problem to look at from a systems perspective.
You can still define certain characteristic of the branching patterns based on mathematical principle. For example, the length of the branches and how many diversions you get at every after a certain distance. And are these values constant from one breast to another, or is it really defined almost randomly?
For the mammary gland, it seems rather random. You don't have a nice distance that's conserved between branches. The analysis of the architecture for the gland, for the mammary gland, has been, you know, it's less intriguing, I guess, to mathematicians and biologists and physicists than perhaps the lung is. But there doesn't seem to be a conserved distance or branching angle or whatnot between from mammary gland to mammary gland. The lung, on the other hand, is very well conserved within a single species, and we're actually finding that some of our manipulations, we can change the size of the lungs, for instance, in a chicken, but the branch points will still scale. Branches will still emerge at the same position relative to the entire size of the lungs. So there are some interesting topological control mechanisms in place that we don't quite understand yet.
Sorry, I'm trying to, new to this screen sharing thing. So for the audience, we're looking as well at, while we're talking here, at the sort of a tree-like structure that represents a mammary gland that going through birth, puberty, and pregnancy. And one of the fundamental questions, I suppose, that keeps coming to me is and it's a question we had with Carla Schatz when she was talking about the formation of the brain. Here you are going from a single cell to an elaborate, complex structure. And so while, you know, we're looking for mathematical constants potentially, as Andre was mentioning, that and that are guiding principles, but really this has to be biochemical and genetic, right? The fundamental characters that are leading to this this complex coral-like structure or tree or coral or branching structure. When you're studying the mammary gland for this tree-like structure, are you using it as a model system for studying fundamental morphogenesis and the guiding principles that could be similar underlying principles to all biological structure? I mean, we're going from a single cell here to an enormously complex multicellular system.
Exactly, we are. Yeah, it wasn't that convoluted. So definitely you have something where that starts out as a population of cells. So in mice, you can build a mammary gland from what's been reduced down to a single cell, but it starts from a population of cells that undergo a numerous symmetry breaking events to form a tree. And branching morphogenesis is just one such developmental program in which you have populations of cells or individual cells forming elaborate tissues. The same is true for, you know, the heart that it's not branched, but you have cells that concertedly loop to form the four chambers. The brain, as you mentioned, is an excellent example of that. So we're interested in how cells learn amongst these populations to take on different roles and to, in the case of the branching program, form a branch, whereas other cells remain quiescent, so to speak, within the trunk. And it comes down to genetics and chemistry and kinetics, but a lot of what we're finding is that the structure at one stage in development, the physical structure, feeds forward to instruct the structures at later stages of development. And this is really mechanical in nature. So a physical mechanical information present within the developing tissue.
So what kind of model do you use to figure out these concepts?
So we take a number of different approaches. Our workhorse model in the lab right now is actually engineered tissues. So for the mammary gland, we build microscale tissues and follow their development as a function of time. We use these because we can control the initial geometry of the tissue and manipulate the signaling within the cells, and then we take what we learn from these engineered tissues and go back into the gland in vivo and test specific hypotheses that have been really revealed to us from what goes on with the engineered tissues.
So
go ahead.
Sorry, stupid Skype lab. Can you define what are microscale tissues to our audience?
Sure, yeah. So microscale, literally tissues that are on 50 to 100 to something less than a millimeter in size. So we use approaches that we adopted from the semiconductor industry, the types of fabrication approaches that are used to build the chips in your computer and your iPhone. We use those same types of techniques to build structures that are on micrometer length scale, but that have features that mimic, in this case, the mouse mammary gland in vivo. So the same diameters, branching angles, and whatnot in 3D. And we follow their development over time under various manipulations.
Literally, micrometer scale. You're making little Borg. Little Borg cultures. I've been watching too much Star Trek. But so, yeah, it's literally a combination of you know, advanced computer chip design with cells that go in. That's just wild. Are you able to, you know, those cells that you make? I've got a bunch of questions, and it's all twirling in my head, to quote a famous politician. So you have these single cells. You've got these cells, but once they start differentiating, it's like lobsters in a pot. They can only go one way, right? Can they de-differentiate? Can they, if you've got a cell that's supposed to be cell, this part of the structure, this part of the branching element, and has information that will carry on the future morphological change or you know, developmental stages. I mean, how do you control what kind of cells are you starting with, and then how do you control what level of biological process that you're sort of studying? At what stage of that development are you studying? So how do you do that with the cells on the chip?
Oh, that's a great question. So we really have to be quite focused in how we ask the questions experimentally in order to avoid some of those complications. So what we do is we start out, at least for our studies of the mammary gland, with mammary epithelial cells, which have the capacity to form mammary gland when injected into mice, essentially mammary trees when injected into mice. They will undergo branching morphogenesis in these engineered tissues. And really, we break the morphogenetic process down into a series of events. So the first event that takes place is a branch has to initiate. So a population of cells has to form a new branch from the initial structure. So we look at branch initiation, and that's what we've been doing for the last several years, and ignore everything else, essentially. And we've identified a number of signals that are important for branch initiation. And now what we're doing is looking at the extension of those branches and how that might feed back onto subsequent branching events. And that's a bit more complicated for us than looking at simple initiation. And it's requiring a lot of real-time imaging. So we do quite a bit of spinning disk confocal analysis of the tissues as they develop. Basically, we have a lot of movies of their development where we can track the individual cells and what they're doing within the tissue. There's seem to be quite a lot of, at least in the engineered tissues, quite a lot of editing that goes on. So a branch might initiate and extend for quite a bit of time, and then the cells that are present in the branch initially won't necessarily stay within the branch. They can move back into the trunk, and that adds a whole host of complications for how we understand morphogenesis. The branch itself might completely regress and disappear, and we don't quite yet understand whether that's something that's important for what's going on in vivo or just an artifact of the tissue culture type of approach that we're using. But it's interesting to think of editing as a possibility for as playing a role, possibly playing a role in tissue development. It suggests that there may be some additional feedback mechanisms that we haven't yet, as a field, considered in formation of organs. So we compare all of this with what's going on in vivo, and as best we can, based on parameters that we've identified, use computational models to explore which parameters might be dominating and to design new hypotheses to test in the culture models and in vivo.
Let me ask you, there's three questions that popped out really quick. What is your starting material for culturing, your primary cultures? And the second question would be, I'm having a Perry moment. So the second question would be, what's the time frame for these videos that you're taking to your imaging analysis? And three, how do you control for contamination? Can you grow these in the presence of strict antibiotics? And lastly, I guess once you've identified potential mutations, do you do genetics on these cells to knock out certain genes, or use drugs to pharmacologically knock out the function of certain targets, and then look at the knockout mice to look at their development? I guess that's four questions, right?
And they'll take the rest of the hour to fill up.
Well, perhaps after our spot. No, let's. I don't want to do too much of a teaser here. So maybe you could. I've got them committed to memory here. So what's your starter material for these microprocessor cultures?
So we start with mammary epithelial cells. So we can use a variety of cell lines or primary cells taken out of mice. They all work the same in our hands, undergo morphogenesis the same. Then you asked about time frame. Initiation events happen fairly quickly, within a few hours. Extension takes a couple of days. And so our movies generally run over a day, 2 days, 3 days. We have a lot of movies running usually on the microscope. Once we've identified potential signaling pathways or genes, then we do quite a bit of genetic manipulations, either within the cells. Typically we use viral approaches for that. And when we can, we screen using pharmacological agents, simply because it's faster.
So that leads to my question. So essentially you change the culture media by adding either a variety of hormones like TGF-beta or EGF or FGF, and you see how these affects the morphology of the branching patterns. And then you can also add pharmacological regions that inhibit or activate these signaling pathways. Am I wrong here?
Oh, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow. That's a lot of work. My God. Well, there's a lot of complexities here, and we're just trying to get our hands around these complexities.
And that brings me to Dr. Laufensberger's work, where he is showing that time courses and interaction between various hormones are really critical in how the cells are going to respond to them. Like, you're doing an experiment with one drug in a very simple defined condition. You're doing it with another hormone in very simple defined conditions. And when you combine them, you get something completely different. And I'm trying to see if you're trying to incorporate this new knowledge of systems biology into how these cells develop.
We are. So on the time scale thing, it does play a huge role. The answer that you get to a question depends on what time you look at. And during development and in an engineered tissue as well as in the body. So we've spent quite a bit of time looking at how gene expression changes within these engineered tissues as they're developing, as a function of time and location. So what cells within a tree are expressing different genes over time. We do see some interactions, some non-intuitive or things that we wouldn't have guessed causing changes when we look at different combinations of stimuli. And again, that requires us to pay attention to the temporal course of things and look very carefully at gene expression changes within tissues as they're forming. So they end up being, you know, large arrays of experiments that we follow in order to really tease out what's going on in development.
So let's ask a very simple question. So when you have a duct cell in a developing breast, so you have like a tube of cells that is forming a duct, what makes it decide suddenly to do and make a branch and make two duct cells out of one? Is there a molecular signal that's been identified in that field?
I'll give you a second to answer that, because what I'll do is I'll take the time, sorry to interrupt, but to go through, get our ad behind us, and then we could see what we've got. Is that okay? All right. I'm not, all right. This is, how's this done, right? Okay. This episode, sorry, gang, I'm new to this. It's only episode 90. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Ford, featuring Available Sync. Sync's entertainment features enable you to access music and podcasts from most devices, including iPods, mobile phones, tablets, or flash drives. And with Sync, with My Ford Touch, you can play videos or display photos from your digital camera or your portable gaming device. But make sure that you're doing it while your vehicle's in park. Actually, I think that's the only time it can actually do it. It's all made possible through a versatile media hub, which supports convenient variety of devices for music and entertainment, such as wired connections from just about any device through USB ports, SD slots, and RCA jacks, or wireless via Bluetooth from a Bluetooth-enabled device. Just connect your devices and play. Once your devices are connected, you can use Sync's voice-activated feature to play just what you want. Just a few simple voice commands. And now I'm French Canadian, so is it play genre or is it play genre? You can just say play genre and it'll probably recognize your accent, and say rock and it'll just play, or play Peter Gabriel, or play a track. You can just say the name of the song, play the artist, name of the artist. It just works. So you don't have to sit and fiddle with buttons. It's really great. Also available with My Ford Touch Sync with My Ford Touch HD Radio. This features iTunes tagging, which lets you tag a song you like on the radio, transfer the info to an iPod, and purchase a song directly from iTunes at a later time. Sync's versatile entertainment features are available on the 2012 Ford Focus, and you can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. So just before the spot here, Andre was asking whether or not you have identified factors that lead to mammary gland duct branching, you know, and I guess that's a great example of how, a great question that one might want to ask with respect to having a system where you can deconstruct elements of morphogenesis, right? So have you guys identified an element that leads to duct branching, for example, or are there other examples where you've identified factors?
Sure. So for the mammary gland, we think we've identified most of the roles that are playing a major role in determining when branches and where branches are going to form. One of those is that there's the cells within the epithelial trees secrete transforming growth factor beta, or TGF-beta. It acts as an inhibitor. And it forms a concentration gradient along the developing duct. And so in regions in which there's a low concentration of TGF-beta, a branch will form. And this typically happens at the end of a tree. So if the tree is my finger, having trouble getting on the screen, but if the end of the tree is the tip of my finger, then at the tip is usually the lowest concentration of this inhibitor, and that's where the cells will form a branch. So you'll see bifurcation there. You also see low concentrations where there's some sort of a curvature within the duct. In addition to that, we've identified that the tissue itself is rather contractile, and mechanical stress is exerted or experienced by the tissue because of that contractility also form patterns along the developing tree. And regions that eventually branch out are those that experience the highest amounts of mechanical stress. And those usually coincide with the low concentration, regions that are experiencing low concentrations of this inhibitory protein, TGF-beta. So they seem to be reinforcing signals. So when you have those two things in culture, and at least based on our analysis of what's going on superficially in the gland in vivo, then a branch will form. And we think that at least for the mammary gland, those are the major instructive roles that determine when and where branches will form. We can't at this point say what determines which direction they move in or extend into, but can at least say for initiation, those are the major roles. And they're both templated and instructed by that initial architecture of the tree. So geometry plays a major role there.
So there's two aspects in breast development that are probably of most interest to our audience. One is, of course, is there anything that you're learning could be useful for breast cancer development? And the other one is, it's a tissue that changes a lot during development. So when you go from childhood to adolescence to when you're in childbearing age, and when you're essentially producing milk, there's huge development in breast tissue, and then it goes back down to, let's call it, normal levels. And then every time you have a child, you have breast development, and then it goes back down to normal. So there has to be a lot of morphological rearrangement in the breast tissue. And I'm kind of curious how that's controlled. And maybe later we can talk about cancer. Let's do development first and then work onto the breast cancer aspect later.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. We haven't even begun to look at how the cyclical changes in the lifetime of the mammary gland play a role in the architecture. I mean, you definitely have pruning that happens during involution. So after a woman or a mouse has weaned their children, then the gland reverts back to a pubertal, I guess, post-pubertal state.
So what are the general concepts implicated in that?
Is it apoptosis or...?
Yeah, apoptosis has definitely been implicated in how the tree goes back to its pre-pregnancy state. We're interested, my group is interested in, you know, the pattern that forms, and I haven't seen anything in the field looking at what controls, you know, where branches might be pruned from the tree, or how many branches might be pruned from the tree. These are, you know, really fascinating questions for how homeostasis is maintained in an adult organism over, at least in people, decades of life. We haven't looked at that at all.
Okay, so what happens in breast cancer, essentially, when you suddenly have a lot, if I remember well, the most common types of breast cancer actually originate from these duct cells?
Exactly, yeah. Something like 90% of breast cancers are from the ductal epithelium. So what happens is a big question that could go many different ways. We think that much of what we're learning is instructive for how one could think about cancer and cancer progression. Many of the genes that we're identifying that are turned on during the branching morphogenesis stages, we're also finding turned on in the human mammary gland in tumors taken from women with breast cancer. Some of the signaling pathways that we're identifying downstream of the mechanical stress signal that I mentioned, we also believe are potentially playing a role in cancer progression. We're at the early stages of these studies, so I don't know, you know, how large of a role they play, but they're definitely in the right place and that they're at the right time to be implicated in tumor progression. Those studies we're doing in collaboration with the Mayo Clinic and looking at how many of these signals are turned on and what prognostic role they might play in what happens with these women.
Are you doing any work with similar structures, branching structures, like as the lung epithelium?
And yes, yeah, so we work with we're doing quite a bit of work on lung, mostly in mice and in birds, so chickens and ducks and quail, looking at the signals that control branching in those organs as well.
Are these the same as in breast?
The signals?
Yes. They're using the same signaling pathways?
Same genome?
It appears that some of the signals are the same. But the rules that we've identified that dominate branching in the mammary gland don't seem to play a major role in controlling branch sites, at least in the bird lungs and in chicken lungs. And there the branching is very different. The branches in a chicken lung actually form from the side of the primary bronchus. So rather than imagining, see if I can get my finger up here right. Rather than imagining a branch coming from the tip of my finger, imagine branches coming from the side of my finger. That's more what things are like in the bird lung. And the inhibitory signal and mechanical signal that we've identified to play a role in specifying branch sites in mammary gland cannot explain the branching pattern in chicken, cannot experimentally explain the pattern, cannot computationally explain the pattern. So
what makes chicken a useful model for studying branching patterns in lung development?
In mammals.
Because that's
a big question, right? These are dinosaurs that, and we're mammals with mammary glands, and it's sort of a
yummy, delicious dinosaur.
So that's the big fundamental thing there. This is a big element. These are the post, cataclysmic asteroid mammals grow and then become the dominant species. But it's the fundamental premise. Are the features that are found in mammalian mammary glands similar in the lungs, and then those differentiate from the non-mammal species? Does that make sense? Maybe I kind of spun it around.
Yeah, yes, the question makes sense. So I think what you're asking is how much of the differences are because we're comparing, in this case, and what I just stated, comparing between mammals and birds, and how many of the differences are because we're comparing between mammary gland and lungs. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's
yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. I'm glad you got it.
So we think it's more that because we're comparing mammary gland to lungs than because we're comparing mammals to birds, although we definitely see experimentally and just by looking at the structures that the lungs in a bird are very different, obviously, than the lungs in a mammal, and they diverged, 300 million years ago or something like that. So the structures are different. The lungs function differently. But you still, in the case of the lung, the mouse lung, which has been examined the most extensively, you still have a different type of branching event than you have in the mammary gland. And there are, again, as I pointed on my finger, there are branches that come largely off the side of the primary bronchus during that development, and those cannot be explained using the signals that we've identified for the mouse mammary gland. So the chicken ends up being a good experimental model because it's inexpensive. You don't have to sacrifice the mother mouse in order to obtain the embryos and look at the lungs. And it develops rather quickly. And actually, it's been a great model for getting high school students and undergrads in the lab. And that's why we started with it. So I, just as I really valued my experience in getting into science as an undergrad, I take that seriously and give other high school students and undergraduate students opportunities in the lab. So it's been a great model for getting us started on the lung, but also for telling us where we, I think as a field in general and as a group, for my group in particular, where we might be making assumptions that don't hold, if that makes sense. So if you read a review on lung development, there are many statements that are made that we're finding, don't hold true between species. And they're probably made simply because we haven't explored too many different model systems, which makes, me concerned about using what we learn for mouse development in general and mouse lung development in particular as a model for what's going on in the human. There are going to be major differences that we can't account for and possibly won't even notice because we don't have human tissues to compare to experimentally. But the chicken work has been a great way for us to get started in looking at lung development and lung branching for various reasons.
So you're using essentially the chicken model to try to identify cytokines, drugs, or hormones that will control lung development, and then you try to see if it's the same that are controlling lung development in mouse?
A little bit of that, and also looking at the cellular mechanisms for how branches form. So you have a multicellular structure that undergoes morphogenesis, so it's changing in shape as a function of time. This is one of those really fantastic moving boundary problems that fascinate mathematicians and physicists and engineers. Some of the cellular mechanisms that we're identifying in the chicken give us a way to pose hypotheses in the mouse, if that makes sense. So there's an unlimited number of hypotheses that you can start out with, and having something that you've already explored sort of refines how you state those hypotheses. So you can, in my opinion, make design more sophisticated experiments if you have some sort of a starting point, a reference frame to look at initially.
So one of the awesome advantages of using mouse as a model is you can come in and knock out specific genes, not only in the entire organism, but you can even go and create mosaic knockouts that, for example, will be missing a specific gene only in lung tissue, for example. So have you been using some of these models, and what have they taught you?
So our work in the mouse is really at the early stages right now. That's definitely one place where we want to go. We're more interested in than the genetics is the mechanics and the process. So mouse, as you've stated, is an excellent model organism and a model system for being able to manipulate things genetically and label different populations of cells, and that's really great for that. Where it suffers in comparison to or when trying to extract or extrapolate information for human disease, is that it's a very small model, very small organism as compared to us. Where that particularly becomes a problem is when looking at issues of replicating some human diseases. So there are a certain class of mechanically induced diseases in human fetuses that cause defects in lung development that result from alterations in mechanical stresses across the growing lung. And some of these include things like a congenital diaphragmatic hernia, where you have a hole in the growing diaphragm and that allows for compression of the developing lungs. And these have been, they typically lead to pulmonary hypoplasia. So babies born with these problems have trouble breathing right after they're born. And it's one of these interesting types of diseases where you have, you know, defects in morphogenesis that result from mechanics, and it's not something that we can treat at the moment. Surgeries have been attempted, and surgery on a human fetus is already going to lead to lots of complications. And so we have a mechanically induced disease and really no idea of what one could do to solve the problem, and where we believe we can offer some sort of a solution is in identifying the signaling pathways, the biochemical signaling pathways, and the genes that are affected by such mechanical alterations. So this type of a disease has been replicated in large animals like sheep and rabbits, but surgically you can replicate it in those animals and look at changes, but those aren't very useful for those large animals aren't very useful for looking at signaling pathways or genetics. And so what we're interested in doing, and where we're moving with the branching studies in lung, is replicating these sorts of mechanical fetal defects, but in a mouse lung. And we're again combining the microfabrication, the computer chip types of approaches with the mouse lung, so that we can alter mechanical signals while looking at genetics and signaling pathways that are turned on or turned off by alterations and pressures. And we're hoping to open up that big black box and really get a handle on what might be affected and whether there might be some pharmacological manipulations that one could propose for combating these types of diseases that really result from mechanical effects rather than specifically from a gene mutation in the lung itself.
So I'm really glad you're young, by the way. this is one of the most complicated scenarios where you're trying to, I guess, you know, we go from single fertilized egg to these massively complex multicellular systems, as I mentioned at the start of the show. And if there's mechanical factors, biochemical factors, genetic factors, and they can't be a few. In one of your reviews, you had this nice list of sort of a chart of elements, and the map was would make Google Earth look simple. And I guess Andre's question whether or not, you know, use mice as genetic systems, even then you could either go with a knockout, and by the time you have enough material to really do proteomics and genomics on, it'll take 9 months to 12 months. So your turnaround, even with a rapid colony amplification, your turnaround is so slow. And then there's thousands of different components. Okay, so maybe there's 200 components, biochemical factors, and those biochemical factors have a timeline, and so the combination of complexity through time also extends and position. My God, it'd take forever to piece this together. So I really appreciate your idea of going in with synthetic tissues, or, you know, on an artificial matrix, and sort of do it in the reductionist approach, and then maybe have other people go and study the factors that you're pulling out and try to validate them in an organism, perhaps pig or... but wow, what a complicated scenario to try and piece this together. How do you... When you get up in the morning, do you...
When?
how do you not go like, oh my God, I've got the most complicated... It's like I'm trying to study the universe. The universe only has like 20 different
kinds of stars. Biology is complicated, Mark. Every system is very, very complicated. Yeah. Once you dig into enough details to figure out how it really, really works.
Yeah.
These are 30-year goals, I think, if we're lucky. So,
right. You started young. You got plenty of time. No gray hair. You're all set.
Yeah, unlike us.
Yeah, your graduate students, though, they'll all have gray hair when you finish.
So
that's great.
You weren't the subject of genetic diseases, and that kind of led me to thinking, is there a genetic disease that will affect lung development is pretty bad mojo. I mean, you're going to be born with non-functional lungs, and your chances of passing on your genes to future offsprings is fairly low. But any genetic disease that would affect breast development, I mean, it's more possible that it could get carried on. So there must be some genetic diseases in humans that will affect branching patterns in human lungs or in human breasts or development of breast tissue. So have any of these been useful in your research?
There must be. But we don't really look at that, right? So you don't notice that you have a problem in your breast until you have kids and try to lactate and try to feed them. And if there is a problem, society is set up such that it's not something we're going to explore, right? I mean, even two generations ago, we had wet nurses. Now, if you have problems feeding your kids right after they're born, we have formula and, if you want to, the milk banks. And so it's not something that's really been looked at. There must be, but we haven't even looked at the problem. I mean, as a field, we haven't looked at the problem.
Well, there's no economic compelling. It's not economically compelling as well. I mean, if you're right. going to fund the research, it'd be very hard to say, well, lactation is a disease. It can happen where there's pathological forms, and it's not really.
There's a lot of people out there who spend their entire days looking at breast biopsies as part of cancer screenings. So they must occasionally come across some very interesting patterns. You're right. It is a purely scientific endeavor in the sense that if your breasts aren't working, you have alternatives out there. But it's giving me some ideas. I mean, there are tissue banks out there that might be worth screening for anomalies in breast duct tissue formation that could teach us a lot about how these tissues develop.
Yeah, you're right. And that would be fascinating to look at. Right now, it's probably just written off as normal variation. But if we combined looking at the architecture of the gland and the extent of branching with some knowledge of people's genotype and what ends up happening to them later on in life, I think that would probably reveal a lot of information, tell us, as you mentioned, about diseases that could be passed on to progeny that we don't have any idea even exist at this point.
Well, I think this fascinating. This is really just an introduction to for us, because it reflects possibly a way to a system that you're developing is a system that we can use to study organ formation as a whole, right? What are how to break down the genetic factors and the biochemical factors and the structural factors and the timing factors, so that we could, potentially make a kidney. Do you see your work as a laying the foundation for understanding morphogenesis as a whole, for the use in tissue engineering? Or is this part of it? Or are you really just focusing on, the beauty of the biology?
We're inspired by the beauty of the biology. Yeah, that question makes sense. So we're definitely inspired by the beauty of the biology, and we keep that foremost in our mind. But I definitely see this as a platform for looking at development in general and morphogenesis in general across different organs. And so I think some of what we're showing is that you can use simple engineered tissues to get at some answers in development, and conversely use those answers to try to permit tissues to build themselves in such a way that you might end up having some therapeutic engineered tissue, so a regenerated tissue or a de novo generated tissue that could be useful for treating various types of diseases. So I'm hopeful that other people will be convinced of this and start to use these sorts of strategies for other organs. As it is, we have our hands full with mammary gland and lung in the lab. So, but I think it would definitely be useful for just as a platform type of model for looking at morphogenesis across a variety of organs for eventual tissue engineering applications.
There's a lot of conditions, human conditions, where people have stunted growth and whatnot, and they are looking desperately for, factors that could lead. So, I guess there are people that are born with small hearts or extra large hearts, and they need to be able to control that. And if you come in with a lentivirus carrying the essential genes to bring that back to a more wild type normal condition, right? When it's an amazing list. So, I'm going to sort of like applaud you here and then suggest that you do take on all the other records and go for it. I guess that's you're going to have a lot of graduates from your lab that are go on and design chips for specialized to other organs. Have you allowed graduate students to come and say, you know what? I like the system, and I'm interested in the structural patterns of the microtubules in the kidney, or something like that, or other morphological structures. Do you allow them to sort of play around with those elements?
As of yet, no. The rule is they can work on anything with mammary gland and lung at this point, until we have stronger foundations in those. Once they leave, though, they're free to work on whatever they want, of course. So hopefully some of them will take up these other organs.
How about one of the big problems in cystic fibrosis research is getting tissue samples or lungs to have fibrosis in a model system, right? The mice, they just don't cough. They don't develop the lung infections. So in drug development, you're as much as you'd like, you have to use systems where you can test it on a mouse and that mouse represents the model. And then you go to cystic fibrosis, well, that mouse just not there. And I think it's one of the major problems in CF research is just the lack of animal models that allow you to get to clinic. Have you thought about that problem of, co-infection, growing these lung tissues and getting co-cultures with what is the bacteria that infects CF patients? I mean, these are major challenges. Have you thought about creating a pathogenic lung tissue for CF research?
Not really, no. But I think in general, these types of approaches are useful for filling in that needed gap, as you mentioned, where you don't have a good animal model that recapitulates the human disease, and you need something that sort of spans that, so you can test for the effects of various drugs. And there are a number of people in the field who are using tissue engineering types of approaches to build diseased tissues in such a way that they have, arrays of something that looks like the human disease, but in an experimentally tractable setting, so that they can start to explore the role of and the effects of different pharmacological agents and screen things in a better setting than, say, a mouse that never develops cystic fibrosis, the fibrosis part, as you mentioned. We haven't looked too much at cystic fibrosis. But it's an interesting idea that you mentioned.
It's not developmental. And I don't mean to distract you from the very complex problem that you're trying to figure out either, though. I could see it's just that you're training a lot of people in tissue engineering, and I think that's a great thing. And I think they're going to go off and explore all kinds of questions just because they have had training in mammary gland tissue. They're going to have such a great skill set. Let me ask you real quickly. This is kind of a technical question, I suppose. When you grow these tissues, you do the video microscopy, do you stop at certain stages when a new formation has happened, grab and grind those cells and do proteomics, or do you prefer readouts from gene chips? When I ask, say, proteomics for the audience, you take the cells, you grind up everything, you throw it to a mass spectrometer, and then you look for the new patterns of proteins that are being made, or do you go after what genes are being expressed, or do you do both?
We've really at this stage focused on looking at the genes that are expressed and haven't done any proteomics yet. I don't know if we can at this point get enough tissue to do proteomics, but maybe in a few more years when we have some new models or better models and the ability to pull apart the various regions. But most of what we've done has been really looking at the changes in gene expression spatially across the tissue as it's forming and how those vary as a function of time.
I think, as the mass spectrometry gets better and better, I think you're going to be able just to grind three cells, put them in a tube, have them fly, and you'll probably get more than 50% of the proteins to fly. And then you could have a beautiful readout. I wish I had one. I can't buy another $1 million, right, for a good one. And then you need a technician who's uber qualified because the consistency of the sample preparation is of absolute exquisite importance. I don't know. It's just really, really hard. Not that DNA gene expression analysis is easy, but if Andre can do it, right? I'm kidding. I'm bugging Andre.
Okay, I'm back.
It's a good thing because I made a joke about you. I was just saying that we were talking about proteomics and whether or not, is it hard to get, three or four cells ground up and get all the proteins to fly? And how does that compare to a gene expression analysis on a cell cultured system? And I said, well, it's very, very difficult for the proteins, but of course, if Andre can do DNA chips, then anybody can do it. That's not true. They're very, very hard.
Yeah, you can do microarray analysis on a few cells. I mean, the methods for linear PCRs are getting better, and I mean now you can do laser capture microdissections where you can really choose which cells you want to amplify and which ones you really want to see the RNA patterns out of. So I mean, the technology is getting there.
Any final thoughts, Dr. Nelson? Where would you like to see this go? What is the next step for you? Give us a 10-year prediction. Let's talk sci-fi here. Or does it be sci-fi? Sci. Go ahead. Sorry.
Sometimes it feels like a science fiction. In 10 years, we hope to understand the mechanical signals that are controlling lung development in such a way that we've identified some factors that one could start to look at in collaboration with clinicians for looking at some of these diseases that I mentioned. In 10 years, we also hope that we'll have enough understanding quantitatively of what's going on in development of the mammary gland that we can describe it with equations and also come up with existing structures that will develop on their own. So what I mean is my vision of tissue engineering is one where you have a final architecture you want to form, and because you know the rules that can lead to that architecture, you build something simpler that will develop into itself. That might take more than 10 years, actually. But that's really where we're hoping to go with these studies.
Well, I'll wish you the best of luck, you've got, you know, I guess you're very ambitious. Clearly, there's going to be an encyclopedia of information that you're going to pull out. It's kind of like exploring the universe. So this is really, really cool. So, and well, with the name like Celeste, Celeste Nelson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for coming on the show. Thank you for coming and taking the time, because I know you've got a lot of work to do. But you've got time. You've got time. You're a nice and young scientist out there in the lab. Go for it. Our guest today was Dr. Celeste Nelson. She's an assistant professor, chemical and biological engineering, and an associated faculty in of the Department of Molecular Biology at Princeton University. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
We were also very lucky to have our resident systems biology subject matter
lucky
expert.
Indeed.
Don't watch the show back. I was making a joke and you weren't around. You weren't there to defend yourself. So my apologies on air.
Well, the lawyers talk so much that after a while you just have to go to the bathroom.
That's okay.
We were late. That's why.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it. I called Andre about an hour and a half before the show, and he went home and got ready and read some reviews too. So that was fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yes, it was a pleasure.
We'll have you back. And Andre is a senior research officer with the National Research Council of Canada and adjunct professor in the Department of
Anatomy and Cell Biology.
Say hi to John next time you're there.
He's not there anymore.
is he at the giant hospital in Montreal?
He's in experimental medicine now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
The man was chairman of the department for, 20 years? It's fantastic.
Yeah, the joys of university politics.
Yeah, well, he's a pretty tough guy, and he brought in a lot of money, a lot of grants, and a lot of great research. And has been a guest on FIB twice, and been a panelist. So fantastic. Well, that's great. Thanks again, Andre. And I will also thank Liz Romero for handling the audio and video boards and the recordings today. She did a great job. Thank you for coming on, for doing this. I'd also like to thank our chief twit, Leo Laporte, and his great team that make this possible. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv, or on Twitter at Mark Peltier. For those that are listening to the podcast, you can join us live on Fridays every second or third Friday. You just have to check the Twit schedule. And we basically go on our guests' availability. So that's kind of how we rotate these shows. So you can listen to us typically at 12:30 Pacific time or 3:30 Eastern time. I'm thinking if 4 o'clock was actually a much better time. So I can talk to Leo about that. So check out the schedule on Twit Live, and then you can tune in and ask questions in the chat room. And we'll do our best to, if we've got a handle, be able to pose them to our guest. So for Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.